Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, and with special guests today, we have the other half calling in from the West Coast live.
Hello. Oh. The other side of the country.
Sounds good.
Yeah?
Yeah, you sound clean. Why don't you introduce yourself? It's been a while.
This is Darren Bresnan. It's the other half of Snacky Tunes calling in from 3,000 miles away. As you know, we've been doing field pieces out here in L.A., and we're going to continue to do some, but wanted to call in for one of our favorite episodes every year, which is our annual trend show. Michael, how are you?
Hi there. It's snowing here.
And it's all your fault. Yes. Well, it's about 65, maybe 70 and sunny.
Oh, man. I'm a big fan of seasons. I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I really do love... I do love snow. I like the winter. I think it's a good time for creativity.
Listen, I think everyone loves the start of winter, and then I think two or three months in, everyone goes, all right, I got it. Like the dirty snow and the cold feet, I think everyone just wants to move on at some point.
Yeah, well, we'll send some dirty snow out to you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is annual trend show, and this I think we did the math. I think this is the fifth year that you've been on doing this. So we've got half a decade under our belt, which is kind of amazing.
You don't look that old.
No. You look even younger than when we started. We want to get right into it because there's a lot to kind of cover in the first year. But I think the biggest topic this year is going to be the abolishment of tipping in the New York and then further U.S. scene. So if you want to maybe give people a quick update of where things are in the no tipping movement, just to catch everyone up to speed. It's a good place to start.
It's fairly complicated.
Yeah.
It's one thing to say we're going to have a restaurant and there's no tipping, that's not part of the American culture, although it's true almost everywhere else in the world. We're unique in the tipping business. There have been in this country a number of very high upscale, high priced restaurants that have the tip built into the price of the menu. That has seemed to work for them. But things have gotten very complicated recently. Minimum wages are going up, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, there are all kinds of new state and federal regulations on how you can handle the money for tips. And the government has been cracking down because in fact, the tips that you leave for your waitstaff only can go to the waitstaff. They can't go to the managers. They can't go to the people who take your coat. They can't go to anybody in the kitchen. The result of that is that as prices have risen in the last 10 years, which they sure have, the waitstaff in the front of the house is making more and more money. But the people in the back of the house are stuck.
Right.
They're working in hot situations. They're underpaid. They're underappreciated. And they are getting really resentful of the spread that's happening between the front of the house and the back of the house. So this is an interesting example of American inequality spreading out.
But the thing that I am surprised about is that I always assume that there was a gap between back of house where, you know, an hourly line cook versus, you know, kind of the how much can I make wait staff. Was the gap just a lot less? Were they a lot closer together? Or was it just not talked about? Because I feel like even back then, you know, even 5-10 years ago, the gap was still there.
The gap was there.
Yeah.
The gap was there. It was nowhere near as large as it is now. But even more important is what you just said. It was not talked about. And as that gap has become increasingly large, it's become clear that the people in the back of the house whose salaries have been kept down are underpaid. Mm. They're underpaid. Let me rephrase that. They're being exploited by the restaurant industry. They are underpaid, and you and I as taxpayers are supporting the restaurant industry with our taxes, because after they get their miserable paychecks, then they get income transfers called welfare, food stamps, earned income credits to top up their income. And that topping up of their income so they can live is paid for us by the taxpayer rather than by the diner and the owners of the restaurants.
And that, I mean, that argument, and I've seen that where it's like that, those fingers are pointed at the McDonald's, Burger King's of the world. But does that statement apply to your, even your like favorite mom and pop place that's like a 40 top? Is it a ubiquitous kind of statement, or is it more like focused on the, you know, fast food industry?
It's a ubiquitous kind of statement. Mm. The resentment, as I said, is building. There is now fomenting a kind of social crisis and a racial crisis. Mm. Because now that I plant this image in your head, you'll find the wait staff in the front of the house is largely white. You'll find that the people staffing the kitchen are mostly people of color, immigrants, it gets a bit shameful.
So then, does the burden become then on the diner to say that if, you know, they want to support going out to eat and adjusting for prices, it's their responsibility to continue the trend of eating out as much as everyone does?
You put your finger on a very important point.
Okay.
Menu prices have been artificially low because of the cheap labor available in the back of the house, and the fact that the diner really pays the wait staff rather than the restaurant paying the wait staff. So if I say to you, oh, well, we're going to have to raise the prices in order to pay the people in the back of the house living wage, and the menu prices are going to go up, then the answer to your question is, yeah, the diner should be paying the bill.
Now, does that mean that we're going to see restaurants close? That some are just not going to be able to adjust to, you know, this new form of paying and tipping and going out to eat?
Assuming that the no-tipping movement spreads, and it is spreading, if it takes hold, then there is a possibility that the consumers will rebel and go out to eat less often, or fewer of them go out to eat.
I mean, and you've already seen some restaurants implement it and then reverse it. Without naming any names, some of them have failed at the experiment. What do you think that does to speak for the future?
There have been restaurants that instituted a no-tipping policy and then reversed themselves because they lost their wait staff.
Mm. Right.
And all that points out to is that the menu prices are not high enough. They're not high enough to support paying an increased minimum wage to waiters, which is happening, and to equitably pay the people in the back of the house, which is why I say menu prices have been artificially low. It may take another 5 or 10 years for this to happen, but if the spread, and it is spreading, takes hold in this country, then we'll be looking at a different set of economics on eating out.
Do you think that we're going to see less...
Don't fight over me, guys.
Oh, sorry. Do you think that we're going to just see less restaurants and maybe more automation?
It could be less restaurants, fewer restaurants.
Okay.
Could be fewer restaurants. On the fast food level down at that price range, definitely more automation. We're seeing a lot of automation right now, even on the customer's side of the equation. When you walk into a fast food joint or a fast casual joint and there's a bunch of kiosks where you can place your order, that's putting the burden on you, the customer, to provide the information to the restaurant rather than you interfacing with a real human being.
Yes, and I think that we're also seeing trends where, you know, as tipping or going out becomes more costly, you're looking at, you know, this, I would say, Uberization of getting food delivered to you, where it's a lower price, it's tipping's not even consideration, and you have essentially endless possibilities to eat at your fingertips without even leaving the comfort of your home.
Well, that's a whole other new revolution. The Uberization of the food business, in part, is what you said, but in part, I think you weren't quite accurate, because the prices of the food that is foods that are delivered to you ultimately will reflect the cost of somebody's gas, somebody's car, and somebody's logistical system, and you're paying willingly, it appears, you're paying for the convenience of having that food delivered to you.
But doesn't it get more? Does it get more competitive though, as you know, more people are offering to deliver food to you at home?
It's becoming competitive in two areas. There are too many companies starting up around the country to deliver food. The big gorillas in this business right now are Uber, Google, and Amazon, and Postmates. Somewhere down the line. But there are startups all over the country that are just burning through money trying to get big enough so that they can either acquire some other small companies or get acquired by one of these big ones. And there's too many of them. They're causing a traffic jam.
And what's interesting is that, as you point out, so many of them are not actually in the food business. They're in the service or customer delivery business,
they're in the logistics business.
And I know that we talked about Uber, but I really was surprised when I saw Uber Eats pop up last year. I was just surprised.
Well, when you think about it, the people who have bricks and mortar stores, and I'm talking mostly about the retail industry, discovered long ago that their customer visits to their stores have been declining, and their business has been declining because people are doing things online. And you can get something delivered tomorrow from Staples if you need a ream of paper for no cost at all. So the next logical step is, well, if we're delivering paper and we're delivering groceries and we're delivering whatever else you want online, and Amazon can get it to you in a day, well, why not food?
Right.
Right.
Especially since people eat every day, but they don't necessarily order a sofa every day.
Have you done any of the at-home, like Blue Aprons? Have you dipped your toe into that water?
We're highly un-American. we don't order it at all, but that's because I have a fabulous wife who's a fabulous chef.
Fair enough.
And cookbook author.
Right.
And so we eat well enough without Domino's.
Now, one of the things about the people in logistics and the delivery service is that, are you finding that restaurants are losing control? You know, I'm at home. I just want ribs near me. The delivery people don't care about giving me the best ribs. They just want to get ribs to me. And I feel like you can, like, pay for, you know, Google search results to get my ribs to the top of the list.
That's a very real complexity that's being added on to the restaurant industry because the delivery people are the tech people. They're not the food people. And your name, when you order something from Google or Amazon or any one of them, you become valuable information to those companies. They will, especially if you're a frequent orderer, they'll know what you like, when you like it, how often you order, how much you spend, and what your rank is on the frequent ordering system scale. And that ordinarily would be the information that a restaurant would want to have. But suddenly there's this intermediary between the restaurant and the customer that's changing the equation of who has the power.
I wonder if Amazon will, like, after, you know, extensive barbecue ordering, we'll just send you, like, you might like an at-home grill book and grill set and try to even cut them out further just to, like, you know, gift suggestions for you and your friends.
You ordered, you ordered ribs. You might like these tongs and this barbecue bar.
I mean, it
it's all possible.
Yeah.
But before that happens, they may, next Thursday, since you ordered ribs last Thursday, send you three places in your neighborhood that will deliver ribs in an hour.
Right.
Oh, yeah. It's Thursday rib night at the, you know, McStuffins, right?
Yep.
So, you know, and, you know, the other thing that we're seeing, and you had brought this up a few years ago, but it's back and stronger than ever, that's sort of competing for, you know, shared place on the dinner plate, are retailers who are once again stepping up their food game in a more gourmet way. I know that you talked about, you know, years ago with Duane Reade having, you know, a grab-and-go section, but now you're seeing Saks Fifth Avenue, you're seeing Outdoor World, you're seeing all these stores that are just being like, come here, stay here, and have great food as you shop.
There's an increasing amount of that happening, and for a very good reason, the same reason that I raised a few minutes ago. Retailers are really scared about the drop in traffic in their stores. And even if you go online from your favorite department store and buy a shirt, you might not buy anything else. While if you're in the store, you have an opportunity to be tempted by two or three other items, and the amount you spend in the store goes up. So we need a way to get people into the stores, and that's restaurants. Again, as I said, you eat every day, but you buy a sofa not too often.
Or a car.
Or a car.
Yeah.
By the way, Porsche has a showroom in Atlanta with a restaurant in it.
Are those restaurants?
One of the big retail companies just bought for $mega million a small but growing restaurant company in Philadelphia.
That's public, right?
Yes.
I mean,
they bought Mark Vetri's restaurants.
Well, what's interesting is like my parents and I ate at the Mark Vetri restaurant that's on the Urban Outfitter campus maybe like over the summer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wonder if that was a coy positioning of Mark, who is a former guest here, or it kind of opened their eyes. But Urban Outfitters has been doing it with like the Gorbals and everything. I feel they were pretty ahead of the trend.
Yes, but now they're putting a lot of money into it. Mm. There are a lot of people scratching their heads wondering why it was necessary to buy a company. But they're going to be expanding not just Mark Vetri's restaurants, but several others as well.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, that you note about, is that you say that it will increase how much they purchase for every hour they stay. So is it something where, like, they'll buy something, they'll eat, then they'll buy something else? Is there
correct
data on that?
Yeah, yeah. The idea of having a restaurant in a department store is that at some point you sit down and have something to eat and get up refreshed enough to continue shopping. And by the way, this is true not only in department stores. These are the same economics that work in museums, which is why they have restaurants.
Right.
And the restaurants are usually next to the gift shop.
Right.
it's also the fundamental economics behind theme parks. Because they know the longer they keep you on the premises, the more money you will spend per hour.
I think Disneyland and Disney World are the kings and queens of keeping you there and having food and options for every desire of all ages.
Correct.
And I know Mark Vetri is a really good example in Urban, but do you have a sense of if these stores are opening restaurants that are competing by the same rules, that they're trying to go after stars and Michelin Guide and be top level stores, or are they, you know, more just about having you know, a vehicle to keep people inside the retail spaces?
Well, you have to be old enough to remember that department stores used to have tea rooms and cafes and restaurants, and they were all badly located. They were upstairs behind the bedding department. And they were badly located in order to drag you through the store so that you would be exposed to the maximum amount of merchandise. About 40 or so years ago, they began to kick these restaurants out because they were no longer productive. Mm. They were moving into big shopping centers where there already were restaurants. now they've discovered or rediscovered the power of food, but they need a very strong marquee out front and big name attraction in order to get people to come, because there are so many strong other competing food ventures around them. So they've had to ramp up the merchandising and the product quality and the merchandising appeal.
Yeah, I mean, go on.
I would say that, I mean, having a Mark Vetri doing some different type of concept within Urban Outfitters, I would go, I think I would go there for the food and you know, for a store that I would not necessarily go to. And that's just one example of just going to seek out a chef that I love, and that's how they get me in as well.
That's correct.
I see a more low common denominator where they introduce the idea of a bottomless brunch, and they just try to take the drunk online shopping experience into real life, and they just give you as many cocktails, and then they just maybe have like a little, like, you know, cart that rolls around. You can order it like dim sum, and then perfect.
We're gonna duty free.
Yeah, like duty free.
Buy some stuff.
We're gonna do a quick musical break, and then we'll be back talking trends. We're gonna play a song from one of our favorite bands, Radical Dads, just because we love them, and now they're actually dads. And then we'll be back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are talking trend forecasts. One of the things that I think is really relevant, because it's going to happen tomorrow, is that Chipotle is going to close all of their stores nationwide for 4 hours to teach their employees about food safety in the light of their not one, not two, but three various outbreaks. Which is interesting because I think in your report, you touched on Chipotle before they kind of found themselves in this type of hot water. But this leads very well into these restaurants trying to get rid of really bad ingredients and moving towards a healthier, cleaner type of eating that the public is beginning to demand.
This is a movement that's been growing for a generation. We used to call people who waved their arms and screamed about what was going into the food we eat as being cranks and malcontents. But a couple of generations of good newspaper reporting, several excellent books, and increasing consumer pressure on the packaged goods industry primarily has caused all the products that you see in the supermarket to start screaming at you that they don't have this, they don't have that.
Right.
There's no GMO in this, there's no hormones in that. Very often there never were and never will be, but it makes a good label.
Right.
And this growing consumer pressure is really what caused the consumer packaged goods companies to clean up their act, and they're still doing it. And restaurants have come along pretty quickly behind it. The thing about Chipotle is that it's not in the same league as what we're talking about, because you know, Chipotle hasn't had any of the chemicals that the restaurants that are taking them out have had.
Right.
Chipotle's problem, I'm going to write about this someday when I get my thoughts in order, so let me bumble something out now.
Yeah, we won't hold you to it.
I think we're seeing the beginning of what I'm calling the war on fresh. And it's because Chipotle has been rubbing the additives mantra into the noses of a lot of other of its fast casual and fast food competitors. You remember Chipotle said that Taco Bell has more ingredients in one of its tacos than Chipotle has in its whole store.
Mm. Right.
So there's a lot of glee and hand rubbing when Chipotle got caught in the trap of norovirus and whatever else their customers got. But that Chipotle problem was the result of iffy sanitation practices, and that can be cleaned up. It was not the result of them poisoning people by putting lead in your food. So there are two separate issues. One is how clean and sanitary is our food supply, and the other is how safe is our food to eat because of the chemicals and additives that have been put into it.
And how much do you think that this is a fad to appease people, and when no one is looking and they forget about it, they move back, versus that this is something that will stick?
Well, I'm not privy to Chipotle's internal workings.
Yeah, but also for the cleaner, healthier menu.
The menu is clean and the menu is healthy and the food is fresh.
So I meant like the fast food, the other ones that do have the additives, the Taco Bells of the world.
Oh, they're going to have to get the additives out.
Yeah,
but
right.
The difference between Chipotle and the fat, or let's say the difference between the fast casual industry and the fast food industry, is that the fast food industry is still selling manufactured food.
Right.
And the reason that you go to a fast casual restaurant is because you can see the fresh ingredients in front of you and have a choice of what you want and watch it prepared. That doesn't mean there's no germs in it. So the challenge is to get the germs out of food that's made by people.
Right.
Do you think that you're going to see an overall shift in the food supply chain because these, you know, these the largest buyers of food and, you know, animal products are making these shifts? Are we going to see healthier, you know, trends in food? Are we going to see less virus? Are we going to see, like, less E. coli across the whole food system in America?
I think there's some rationalization to be done about the food distribution system. And in part, it's what you just said. If you look at the rise in, say, organic products, and then you scratch your head and you say, well, this organic product that I just bought at the farmer's market, how sanitary is that really? What sanitation controls are imposed on that part of the product chain, as opposed to Campbell's Soup buying 40 million tons of carrots with a certain set of specifications of what has to happen to it after it comes out of the ground.
Right.
All of that needs to be rationalized. So there's two things going on. One, we want our food to be safer. More and more of us want it to be organic, which means we don't want to have chemicals thrown on it. There needs to be a rationalization of the whole system.
I mean, I think we're also seeing with these, you know, health and diet concerns and people being, you know, a little afraid of what's going on in the, you know, especially the meat industry with hormones and rising prices. You know, vegetables are really getting a huge push by some of, like, the top restaurants where meat is either moving way to the side or off the plate entirely.
You know, this is something that happened all by itself. It didn't require an advocacy, and it didn't require groups of people stampeding through the streets waving placards that we want our vegetables. It's been growing over a couple of decades to the point where restaurants just quite naturally have been ramping up their vegetable presentations.
It's a nice pun.
I didn't realize that. I wish I could do that again. Restaurants have been ramping up their vegetable presentations, and also the quality of the vegetables that they buy, and the amount of skill and talent that they're willing to pay for to apply to the restaurants. So it's not just a bunch of steamed broccoli with a lump of butter on it. They're treating vegetables with the same respect as they are fish and other forms of protein.
And I think, you know, when you look at what Dan Barber and his team have been doing, we ate there, you know, a few years ago, and the thing that stuck out to me most the entire dish was the dish of the parsnip cake. And we did have proteins and everything like that, but I remember that for the first time thinking, this is better than any of the meat that we ate for the entire meal.
Yeah.
Also, Mark Vetri, to go back to him, has this 10-hour tart that, you know, I can still remember all these years later. And I think what we're beginning to see is, or we're getting to learn what people have known for a long time, is that you can get deeper, richer flavors out of vegetables than you sometimes can even get out of certain proteins.
There's, yes, you're right. And there's a big movement toward roasting vegetables, which in a sense is a way of evaporating the water in them, and getting a bit of char on the outside so that the vegetables, in fact, become more meaty in flavor and more meaty in texture, because they chew differently when they're roasted than when you just throw them in a pot of water. I should add, by the way, that my wife, Roseanne Gold, in one of her cookbooks, has a turnip torte. That's every bit as good as Vetri's.
Next time she comes in, we'll have to try a couple of slices.
Of course, your listeners should know that we're sitting here eating Roberta's fabulous pizza.
As always.
Now, I, you know, the thing that we're also seeing, and just to sort of come full circle, is that you're seeing McDonald's, who are trying to rebuild their healthy image, especially in places like Japan, adding more vegetables to different patties and sandwiches.
It's necessary all over the world. And in Japan, McDonald's has a turkey burger that has edamame and corn inserted into it so it looks like it's partly vegetarian and part meat. And by the way, that's not a bad way to go. There's nobody, yeah, that, nobody that says that you have to be a vegetarian in order to enjoy your vegetables. So it's not a question of I'm going to have vegetables or I'm going to have meat, but I'm going to have more vegetables and less meat.
I mean, I think that's one of the interesting tactics that even caught my attention, where it might have used to been all or nothing, where now you see it's like if you just eat less beef and if you just stick to like chicken, for example, that's less harmful, and it's a slow kind of like education of like a really gradual reduction in steps. You know, it's like a 2% change as opposed to a 50% or 100% change.
It's true. And there's something else that's been going on. The gluten-free movement, which has expanded beyond any reasonable use, but the people who are avoiding gluten, and even on a larger sense, the people who have been avoiding carbs that come from the white stuff, which rice, pasta, bread, potatoes, those people are now getting vegetables, but they're different vegetables. They're now green vegetables. Mm-hmm. They're yellow vegetables. They're orange vegetables. And so the nutritional value of what they eat versus the carbs that are in them, that equation has shifted. And so it's not a question of getting a bigger lump of mashed potatoes next to your steak. It's the idea of getting a small piece of steak and a whole bunch of really good fresh vegetables.
I do have to say, before we move on, if you like what we're talking about, The Third Plate by Dan Barber is an excellent, excellent book that really talks about the future type of plate, where what you just spoke about, where a meat gravy is about the only type of meat that finds its way onto a vegetable-rich dish.
Yeah.
But yeah. It's not now, all vegetables, though.
No, pork products and vegetables go very well together.
Yeah.
Now, we don't want to think that cleanliness and no animal byproducts and healthy living are the only trends we're seeing for next year, because the sandwich of the year, you're calling it now, is the fried chicken sandwich, which is a favorite of our family and sort of popping up on everything from Shake Shack menus, secret menus at night market. Why has the fried chicken sandwich become the go-to sandwich for all these restaurateurs and chains?
Damned if I know.
But you'll eat them. Damned if you know, but it's delicious. Right?
No, it has. Look, fried chicken has a lot going for it, not to mention the calories and the fat and grease and salt that come along with it. But
love it.
But it, look, it makes noise in your head and your mouth when you eat it. Noise, sometimes we describe as the sixth flavor. It makes noise. It's succulent, there's been a movement in the food world at all levels to gild the lily. What I mean by that is that chefs have been highly creative up and down the price scale in adding all kinds of outlandish things to outlandish things.
Right.
So, you know, if you want to say the start of it was Roy Choi in California with his Korean ingredients in a taco.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that spread like a plague. So what you now find is chefs and creative cooks starting to put fried chicken on their menu, fried chicken sandwiches, with all kinds of ethnic ingredients on them. So it's not just a fried chicken sandwich. The message really is the condiments that's on them.
Is it that thing where every culture has their version of a fried chicken dish and it's just being reinterpreted as a sandwich?
That's highly possible. It's also possible, or equally possible, that chefs are just inventing wild things to put on food.
What's the craziest one that you've seen?
I did see a fried chicken sandwich that had all the ingredients that would go on a bacon chili cheeseburger.
Oh.
Oh my god.
Okay.
Now, by the way, you know, a couple of years ago, Kentucky Fried Chicken had a sandwich, the name of which I don't
recall.
Double down, yeah. Where they got rid of the bun, and instead of the bun were two pieces of fried chicken with lettuce and tomato between them.
Soothsayers, if you will. We're going to take a quick musical break with the band Pre, who played in live in studio last year, and then we will be back to close things out on Food Trends for 2016. And we are back. One of the really interesting things that are kind of coming, we won't really touch on this, but I think with the rise of food halls and the kind of with food trucks and everything, we're getting more and more access to different ethnic cuisines. And I think what comes with that is the spices that come with those cuisines. And I think that what we're seeing now is a larger introduction to where you might not have otherwise gotten access to, like, you know, quote unquote, authentic flavors. You're getting a touch of that. How do you see that kind of influencing food in the coming year, and, you know, mining, you know, your cultural heritage to bring a new type of flavor to the masses?
Wow, if I could answer that, I'd join the Republican I'd join the Republican debate. Actually, I think something different is going on in food halls, but let's stay with your point. There's a provisional nature in a food hall that says that it's got a whole bunch of tenants, and either they make it or they don't. And if they don't, then they're replaced by somebody else.
Mm. Right.
So these are great venues for experimentation, because you know, the whole business won't collapse, just one tenant might. And so you can take risks on local operators coming into a food court and producing high quality food and hope they make it. I think what's going on in food halls is something that's quite different. I think the original intent of a food hall is what you just said, but it's taken a whole different turn. And food halls are now being populated by people who already have successful restaurants, who have a track record, who have the same ability to draw in people as the restaurants that the department stores are putting in.
Right.
So we're in a kind of winner-take-all economy, whereas if you have a successful restaurant or two, then you get to open a whole bunch of more successful restaurants. And if you're a mom and pop who nobody ever heard of, the landlord doesn't want to talk to you.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's I guess safety and investment.
Yeah, we talked a couple of years ago to a whole group of people from Singapore who wanted to explore the feasibility of opening a big Singapore-type food hall in New York. And if you've been to Singapore, you know there's every ethnic cuisine in the world there.
Right.
And we said to them that there was no need to do a feasibility study. They should just do it. Well, being who they are, they got back on the airplane and never returned. But they shoulda. And so now we have Anthony Bourdain talking about opening a massive food hall in which a Singapore food court will be just one component.
Right.
So,
right.
So the moral of the story is, if you think of a good idea long enough, someone else will do it.
Yeah. You know, just to touch on one thing with the spice blends and what's going on, especially in America, it'll be interesting to see, to track, you know, this people coming in from Syria and from the Middle East now, and to see, you know, this is sort of the year zero for that, and like to watch how those flavor profiles spread across America, and to like actually track it when people are aware of it and knowing when it started, and to see like at what point do those become like integrated into, you know, the mass food cuisine, if they get integrated.
Well, we have a lot of evidence of that having already happened. Every time there's been a political or an economic upheaval or revolution somewhere in the world, a new cuisine is introduced to the United States because of all the immigrants who come here. And the prime example of it going mainstream more recently than most is Thai food. And the Thai people came in the aftermath of the Vietnamese War and settled in Texas to a large degree, where they became shrimpers and moved into other cities as well and began to serve their own food to their own population. All the rest of us caught on to it. And this is, by the way Chinese food became popular in the United States. What happens is you get enough of a concentration of an ethnic group, and they begin to cook their own food for themselves. And then some nosy food writer spoils the whole thing by discovering it.
And now also, you know, it's not just sort of the big cook cuisines, but, you know, with these different ethnic groups coming over, and also with different flavor profiles, you're seeing different types of snacking. And snacking is sort of this, you know, medium soothsayer oracle of how flavor profiles are changing here and then across the world.
You're absolutely right. If you want to know how America's eating, just take a quick walk down the snack aisles in supermarkets. We've become a nation of pepperheads. And to a large extent, by the way, we can blame the same Thai people. we become a nation of pepperheads and are now discovering that heat is not necessarily enough. If you look at what the big spice companies are doing, when you go to the spice shelf in a store, you're used to seeing pepper and cardamom and cinnamon and cloves, each in their individual bottles. But they're now coming out with regional and ethnic spice blends, because we're not just interested in the heat, but we're interested in the underlying flavor behind that heat. So you'll find a lot of that going on in the snack aisle, where a variety of spices are added as overlays to things on chips, popcorn, and all the new kinds of snacks that you get, from dehydrated seaweed to black bean cakes. They're all getting an application of these ethnic spices. What's also interesting in the snack aisle, and maybe even more important, is that they're getting an overlay of health. I don't think this is necessarily a good thing, but if you look at the labels on the packages and you say, "Oh, our tortilla chips have quinoa in them," there's a lot of that going on, and so it makes a bad snack seem good for you, even though it's got the same. There's a French word for it called chazerai. It's got the same chazerai in it.
Now, as we turn to like, the last few minutes of the show, talking on some buzzwords, some quick trends, and as you said, you know, mentioned just briefly that sometimes heat is not enough, and you know, one of the most popular dishes is Nashville hot chicken, which is one of the hottest dishes on any menu, but the flavor goes beyond the heat and the chicken itself, and you're seeing it everywhere from Nashville to L.A. with, like, Howlin' Rays and beyond.
Nashville hot chicken hit the airwaves a couple of years ago very quietly, and it's now being served not only everywhere, but I believe either this month or next month that Kentucky Fried Chicken will roll it out nationally. So, you know, there goes the neighborhood.
Yeah. But
this is a chicken that, depending on where you are, is either dipped in a very hot sauce before it's breaded and fried, or it's breaded and fried and then tossed into the hot sauce the way buffalo chicken wings are. And there'll be a competition to see who can blister your lips worse.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Princess Hot Chicken got a James Beard Award, I think it was a couple years ago. And I think people saw, there's something we can go.
Yeah.
To continue the 2016 buzzwords, seasoning is something you touch on, which is Everything Bagel seasoning mix. Where do you see that growing, or how do you see that being applied?
I just saw a grilled short rib. By the way, it's not easy to grill a short rib and have it come out edible.
Yeah.
I just saw a grilled short rib with Everything Bagel seasoning on it. I've seen pastrami with Everything Bagel seasoning.
I would definitely eat that.
I guess, me too.
I would eat that.
So I'm waiting for one of the spice companies to come out with a mixture.
You're also seeing, you say, General Tso's flavorings everywhere. Where have you seen that outside of your standard Chinese styrofoam container?
I can't remember which restaurant it was, but I was just in the last 3 or 4 months had General Tso's sweetbreads.
I've had those before too.
They were served in nuggets, and they were served as a snack.
That's pretty good.
And
would you order them again?
Would I order them again? Sure.
Yeah.
If I could remember where it was.
Peter Meehan from Lucky Peach was on last week, and we touched on ramen. Ramen is obviously just continuing to grow, which I think everyone wins. Do you think that ramen will continue to be traditional, or do you think we'll see chefs do their own spin on ramen and localize it for local flavors?
Oh, I think everything is being given its own chef spin.
Right.
right.
Some of which I don't understand at all, especially on the spirits end of the business. I can understand why you put honey and Tabasco sauce in bourbon, and that's because you want to sell it to people who don't like bourbon. And I can understand all the flavors in vodka, because vodka has no flavor anyway.
Fair.
Right.
But I was talking to a gin distiller from the Cotswolds. He just opened the Cotswolds' first gin distiller. It's called Cotswold Gin. And he's also making whiskey. And he said there was an attempt in England a couple of years ago from one of the Scotch whiskey distillers to age the Scotch in Tabasco barrels. And I just have to scratch my head and say, why would anybody want to ruin Scotch like that?
I mean, right.
I mean, there are just some things where more is not more. And it's just, and I mean, I get it. You need to diversify your products and, and, you know, it can't just be, you know, one type of whiskey. You got to have apple flavored, you know.
I don't think you need that.
Like
I would say I don't think you need that.
Yeah, I think people try.
I think one of the reasons you need it. Oh, we don't need it. And I.
We don't need it.
The people who are making this stuff are fighting for visibility and shelf space.
Yeah.
So whether it's six variations on ketchup or 13 different flavors of mayonnaise or 22 different flavors of vodka, they're all fighting to get more and more shelf space in the liquor stores and supermarkets.
If they want it.
Yeah. Now, if they want it. Now, I think what we're going to have to end on is the most future of all of your trends and predictions and buzzwords for next year and probably beyond, but it's 3D food printers, and the idea that you could, well, I don't even know, I mean, for those who don't know what 3D printing is you design something and it's printed layer by layer with some sort of plastic, and you can create rings and necklaces and things like that, but how does it apply for food that is edible?
It's not just for making trinkets. Many of the exotically shaped parts that go into airplanes are printed by fundamentally what is a technologically equivalent of a Xerox machine. Mm-hmm. And it, as you said, it applies layer by layer the various components. And when you're all done, you've got a widget. And you can do the same pretty easily now with chocolate and other similar sweet desserts where you just when I say layer by layer, you may have 50,000 layers before you're through.
Yeah,
but it'll come out an eclair.
And I mean, and the misnomer, it's easier to say 3D printing, but the original name is additive manufacturing, which is a better way to wrap the head around. And I think the headlines of you know, Burger in the Laboratory, which is not essentially 3D printing, but if they can build proteins like that and then apply it to a printer. You know, it's not hard to see how you could then get a replicator like from Star Trek.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah. Well, before we get out of here, we want to just, thank you for coming on and see what you have. What do you have planned for 2016? Any exciting projects of your own?
Well, we're working on an underground steakhouse underneath the aged Hotel New Yorker in Manhattan. In what was once, several decades ago, a Chase Bank vault.
So that
sounds like it'll be fun. And we're working with a startup begun by a bunch of overeducated Chinese students who are getting their PhDs at Yale University, because they got bored one night and won a contest, are now have just opened their first restaurant called Junzi Kitchen, and it's a Chinese, Northern Chinese equivalent of Chipotle.
Oh, wow.
Huh. Wow.
Okay. Well, we'll be there.
Okay.
It's good.
Wait, what type of are they serving? Is it fast casual? Like
it's fast casual. They're serving bings and bowls. A bing is a Chinese flat wrap that's thicker and more flavorful than your normal tortilla. And it's filled with whatever you want. It's filled with braised meats, chicken, pork, tofu, each with its own distinct flavor profile. Very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of fresh stuff to go onto it.
Well, of course. In keeping with current trends.
Of course.
So thank you for coming on. Where can people go to read the report for this year?
Oh, they can go to your website. It's www.baumwhiteman.com.
Awesome. And they can also find your contact information as well if they want to pick your brain on any possible projects.
They can. I'll just leave it all exposed.
Oh, perfect. Well,
awesome.
Darren, thanks for calling
in.
Well, good to hear your voice live.
My pleasure.
And thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And we will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.